Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Chips of Chorlton. We're back in my house and I'm joined by Duncan.
Hi.
I've got Andy and Rob over there on one mic.
Hello.
Hiya.
And very special guest this week.
Very special guest. Just guest.
From seminal indie band Airship. We are joined by Elliot Williams, of course, of editors as well. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
No, it's absolutely a pleasure. So we usually, we do a bit of around the houses of what everyone's been up to. My life is extremely boring and you've just been on tour around, playing in front of thousands of people. How's it going?
It's been good, yeah. We just finished our UK tour. And then we did a gig in Bilbao, which was kind of, I guess, an off-season festival kind of thing. Yeah, but it's been great. Obviously, you came to the Manchester gig.
Which was really, really... It was really... Tears for sorting that out. It was, yeah, I loved it. I was just saying before that first time I saw Editors was around the time The Backroom was released.
Yeah.
And we booked the tickets for Academy 3 and they got bumped up to Academy 1.
Yeah.
We are signed to support and we were chatting before. We both at that gig, weren't we?
Yeah, I was supposed to... I was at that gig as well,
We were there too.
Were you?
I believe we were front row.
I was pretty sure
we were front row because I remember seeing...
Well, actually, were the cinematics on first?
Yeah, they were.
We were all at this gig.
See, we were all at this gig.
I remember seeing the bass player snap two strings out of passion.
I thought it was Tom that snapped a load of strings, but anyway, yeah, by the way.
Oh, no, Tom snapped a load of strings, but even the bass, even bass strings were getting snapped that night, because I think it was like the biggest, it was the biggest gig of their career at that point, wasn't it? It was very much, it was an elevation, from Academy 3 to Academy 1.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a big moment.
And I'm not too sure too many bands have actually done that, Academy 3 to Academy 1.
Bypassed Academy 2. Seen a lot of bands go from Academy 2 and then downsize to Academy 4.
Of course.
Who you supported specifically. I remember Perry, what was his name from Jane's Addiction?
Oh God!
Of course, yeah.
It was going to be a massive gig for you, Neil, that you were going to be supporting Perry from Jane's Addiction at Academy 2, and then so few tickets have been sold, it got downgraded to Club Academy.
And he even
had applause coming out of the PA.
I've heard this before.
Nuno Betancourt was his guitarist for that tour.
What'd you say?
Jesus Christ, it's extreme. He wrote more than words.
Wow, okay.
Oh, my mum loves that song.
Jesus fucking Christ, you guys.
I can only think of It's Only Words by Boyzone.
That's a great song as well, though.
Is that Boyzone or is that Westlife?
It's Westlife. I think it's Westlife.
One of the albums that I used to listen to as a kid because my mum bought it from that song, not realising that Extreme was a hair metal band.
Yeah.
And then I pulled it out of the drawer at some point and was like, this is awesome.
But going back to the editor's gig, was that the moment where you just sort of went up to them and said, can I be in the band?
Yeah, totally. No, I think this is a bit of an in-joke within the band, but I think, you know, Russell asked me, he's like, so, you know, you came away from that show, you know, what did you do? I was like, I bought We Are Scientists t-shirt.
Yes.
I loved We Are Scientists.
They were amazing
on that show, weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
Editors weren't amazing as well, but they were definitely two acts that were on the up at that time.
Yeah. Of course.
So if you could go back in time, would you join We Are Scientists instead?
Or the cinematics?
Oh!
No.
You made the right call, I think.
That's good. That's a good question, though, isn't it? Like, kind of, if you could, like, any of the bands that you, any of the indie bands, say, that you used to see in the, you know, Academy gigs growing up, like, if you could join any of them, which
Lady
would you
Fuzz,
join?
Mate. Lady Fuzz.
You've already beaten to it there, haven't you?
Here we go again. Yeah.
My heart was actually absolutely broken in two when they got that 4 out of 10 in NME for their album, and then about bought it and then went, yeah, it's fair.
Right. I think for me, it'd be The Departure.
The Departure, yeah, of course I do.
Yeah, this sort of similar time.
Yeah. I was talking about this with someone recently. I wonder what happened to The Departure. I don't think I've known them to go on to do...
The singer of The Departure started out the 80s club night in Manchester, Girls on Film, with Hattie from Radio X. Those two... Because I remember DJing in places around Manchester whilst those two were kind of... wrecking around venues, just sort of doing their research as to what they were going to do, because they were DJing together at the time. And I remember they started Girls on Film at Deaf Institute together, and then he either left under incredibly bitter circumstances or he got sacked. Something happened like within about a year of him being involved in Girls on Film. Wow, but I remember I kept seeing him around with Hattie Pearson. And I remember like the first few times I met her, I always asked the same question, like, that is the guy from The Departure, right? She was like, Everyone, it is, but he doesn't want to talk about it. I was like, yeah, I thought that was him. I really think, yeah, that's definitely him, isn't it?
All Maps Out came up on my iTunes the other day or whatever, and I was thinking, you know, it's a banger. In terms of an indie banger, you could bring it back into indie DJ sets now.
Yeah, there is a big shout for the whole Camden rock, well, not Camden rock, but Camden indie, sort of anything that was kind of Dublin Castle. I'm thinking of like that, and also Apartment. Is it Apartment?
Oh, yeah.
Oh my god. What was that one?
Patience is proven. And that One Boy Kill Boy B-side, that was all right. Last of the Great.
I thought it was Last of the Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought Boy Kill Boy were. I don't know. I thought it was kind of the death knell for that sort of era of, you know what I mean? It was all changing at that point. It's all about publishing contracts.
I know that we've all got Boy Kill Boy beef, haven't we? From back in the day.
What's that?
How so? Go on.
Yeah, of course.
Wait, what?
Robin knows.
I remember this.
Go on. So, Tell it.
It was a V-Man gig, wasn't it?
Yeah, so this is going back in the day.
Oh, shit. Yeah. You beat us to the crunch.
Yeah, I think it was in my very first incarnation of bands, Astro Boy. And there was a promoter in Manchester called V-Man that we all used to...
Vuz Kapoor. I don't know the best way to describe him. Well, he was pretty much a paid-to-play entrepreneur before that really had the stigma
of
actually
entrepreneur.
Paying
to play. It's a bit of a mercenary, ultimately.
Yeah. I remember he loved us because the first gig we did with him, we sold 100 tickets. So then he was always like, oh, he can always come back. Then we tried to get on the Maximo Park gig he had at Dry Bar the next week or whatever.
Oh, he told us to get fake IDs.
Yeah, he was imploring us to get fake IDs, and it just so happened that he sold fake IDs for people. So he was basically trying to, like, the money we'd made from that gig, he was trying to take it back off us to give us fake IDs to go to Maximo Park.
I'm not sure I ever got paid for a Vuz gig.
Really?
No. Even though we sold...
Even the Boy Kill Boy one.
Even the... I mean...
Boy Kill Boy, technically, you didn't sell his tickets. I can't remember this Boy Kill beef.
So to put it into context, you know, Boy Kill Boy, when you first saw that video on MTV2, what was it? What was the song? Civil Sin.
Terrible song.
I rang you up to tell you how good it was. Yeah. Like, I've seen the future of. They've got everything. They've got like a little bit of atonal angst. They've got the bit where it goes like, you know, they're just the stomps. Yeah.
The singer's got that awkward Paul Weller haircut going on.
Clearly 40, but that's the point.
How old were Boy Kill Boy when they came out? I think that is.
Mid-30s, I reckon.
They must be 50 now. But the fact that we always adhere to the Boy Kill Boy lore is that they were so old when the first album came out that there's still the chance for us.
There's a chance for everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, then,
anyway, what was the...
They then booked them. Academy 3. And, you know, we thought we were shoo-in for it. And then our arch rivals, Astro Boy, got the gig.
We got the gig. We sold, I think, 150 tickets, maybe.
Jesus.
But I remember doing some of those Vuz gigs at the time. You know, this was at a time when we were probably all in school and college, and selling 150 tickets to a gig where, you know, most people can't go and drink in a bar, but they probably could go and drink in the Academy 3 or whatever then, or other venues around town, was quite easy. I remember we did a gig with Captain and Vuz, you know, I met him in some car park in Manchester. He came up, he was like, need you to sell like 200 tickets for this gig. I was like, cool, I'll do it. Got back on the train, went home, went into school the next day, whatever, sold all the tickets. And I remember like 3 weeks before the gig or something, Vuz ringing me up, he's like, you got those tickets? I was like, no, I sold them all. He's like, oh, but the band are really popular now. and they're probably going to sell this gig out. So can you get the tickets back? It's like, I've sold them all. He's like, can you not go and ask people for their money back?
Well, was everyone else put up to this week?
So not touring the UK. That's what we're going up to.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing? You've done nothing this weekend, have you, Andy?
Literally nothing.
You went to a techno club.
I went to a techno club, yeah. Me and Elliot were talking before about going to a club in Suffolk called Hidden and feeling incredibly old there. I mean, you did the more brave thing of going on your own, though, and standing at the back.
I have been before, yeah, to see people that want to see and had the the slight realization that you can't just go to clubs on your own.
That's just 'cause you're not drunk enough, though.
Yeah, especially when you're not drunk enough.
Yeah. Stoptober's been happening. Everything have been doing it publicly as a band, gathering up money. I've got a text off Jeremy about how that's been going. It's very interesting for them, in the way that it's excruciating for them. And of course, it just got me thinking about sort of bands and charitable causes and the way that sort of charities do. Obviously they don't use bands for their fan base or anything like that, so to speak, but charities do sort of seem to attract towards bands and try and get sort of combinations going off together to try and raise awareness for things. And of course, Elliot, you've had some very personal endeavors within that, like you've had some very practical hands-on sort of trips with that.
In Edit as well, we do a lot of work with Oxfam. I think, you know, we've been supporters for Oxfam for a long time and had them out on tour and things to raise awareness. And I guess we got slightly more involved after we did a thing with them. They did a compilation at Glastonbury. I can't remember the year. It was maybe 2013 or something. It's like a Stand As One campaign about refugee awareness and stuff. And myself, Tom and Ed from the band have been to a refugee camp in Greece before. And then we went to one in Serbia, yeah. And yeah, they're incredibly harrowing experiences and you learn a lot. And I guess the reason why I wanted to be involved with that in the first place was because we all play football together sometimes. And
well, indeed, are we letting people into the showbiz life of interband seven aside
intricacy of it all? We play football together, and obviously there is a our friend Yasser, who is a Syrian refugee, and he had an amazing story, which is was in The Guardian. I can't remember the
gist. It's well documented. Helen Pidd wrote a great story on Yasser and then invited him to live with her for six months.
So I think I'll tweet out the story as well. It's really, really fascinating. But from a roundabout way, he's ended up in this kind of hipster band football group, as it kind of was then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he's just kind of, it's sort of absolutely nuts. And that's probably, sort of helped inspire you. Yeah.
And, you know, then obviously when we're having discussions with Oxfam, it felt a lot closer to home than, you know, maybe something else before. And I felt like it was a worthy cause to get involved with and try and share awareness on, you know, the subject of refugees and try and hit home that these are just ordinary people that are trying to make a better life for themselves.
It's interesting that everything have done the Stoptober tour. Jeremy says that the other three have been getting on with it fine. Jeremy found a loophole where you could pay £15 a day for every day you've fallen off the wagon, a golden ticket, which he has contributed to several times. So a lot of the money has come from his own pocket, but they've made four figures. They've made thousands of pounds. Yeah.
Wow.
For Stoptober. And that's incredible going. Congratulations to them.
Yeah,
it reminds me that a previous member of our band did Stoptober when we were touring with them in 2013. And I don't know, like it was a bit of a weird time because obviously it was kind of a breaking point on some personal levels, and I don't know why it was, but it just was. But at the same time, I'll only ever remember that experience as like everything. They found out that one of us was doing Stoptober. I remember they came into our dressing room and just kind of started criticizing the beers that we even had in our dressing room. Anyway, it was like, we didn't ask for 12 Carling. Your promoters give us this. Like this is the easiest tour to not drink on ever. It's like this isn't really a challenge for us in some respects.
Everything said like we'll sort that out for you guys. That's fucking bullshit. We're not having this. We'll sort it out.
They did sort it out
next
for
day,
like
12 Budweisers.
So you guys have known each other for ages, haven't you? So it's not like we just messaged you randomly and like, you're a fan of the podcast. You actually know each other. We played football together and things like that. And you were in several bands, obviously, before you became a permanent member of Editors.
Yeah.
How did that happen? From me, again, being a session guitarist, etc.
I thought you could say, I suppose, from me. Really wanted to be an editor.
How
does that
basically
happen?
I love editors, yeah. So how did that happen? How did you make the jump from the bands you were in at the time to being...
Well, at the time I was in a band, I guess, called Airship, who were Manchester-based. And at the time we had the same management as Editors and we went on tour together a lot. They took us out in the UK and Europe So obviously we built up a personal relationship, and obviously when things went south with Chris, who was the guitarist at the time, and he left the band, they asked Justin, who was, for people that don't know, he was in Your Code Name Is Milo, among other things, and myself to join, because they'd booked, which is kind of crazy really, but they booked a massive festival headline slot in Belgium, and they kind of agreed to do it, and so they wanted Justin to come in and play guitar and sort of, you know, take that traditional role, but then also have maybe me in there is kind of like a bit of help and make it less daunting or overwhelming. So yeah, we got into the room to rehearse and basically get ready for this big festival show, and one thing led to another and we kind of all really got on, and then after a couple of weeks of routining the tracks, we started messing around with new ideas and things, and it just kind of progress naturally, I guess.
So was that gig in Belgium the biggest gig that you'd ever done at that point?
Biggest gig that I'd ever done, and that the band had ever done as well.
Really? So yeah. it was a big deal, not only for you, but for the rest of them.
It's a festival called Rock Werchter in Belgium. It's about 80,000 people, and they'd taken a punt on the band to headline, and yeah, it was massive. It was a big thing to walk into.
Yeah.
It was very intimidating, but
it's almost
at the same
like some kind of monster-esque, isn't it? It's like it's the Rob Trujillo thing, though, isn't it? It's like, right, here's your first gig. It's all of LA.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely, you know, when the phone call came through, I was like, yeah, I think I can do this. You know, you have a lot of self-doubt. I was like, can I do this? I don't know if I can.
Yeah.
I remember going back to my flat and like trying to learn the songs or whatever, and I was like, I think I can do this, but then the next day I just feel like, I don't think I can do this.
Elliot, you should try learning fucking God Boy. Seriously.
I mean, you know, fortunately, you know, because I don't class myself as like a, I don't really see myself as a musician in some senses. I'm not like the most gifted guitar player. I'm not like the most gifted pianist or anything. I can't read music. I'm not like, so I see myself much more in like a creative, like I can chip in with ideas and stuff. So I guess that was my biggest like insecurity. It was like, I'm going to do this gig and they're going to ask me to play something super tricky and I'm just going to be like, I don't know how to do it.
Yeah. But on the night.
Yeah,
well.
On the
like,
night.
Like, you're Elton John, right?
Yeah. No, yeah. Let's just start this duet. Just follow me for the changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep it snappy. Keep the bass lines walking.
Yeah, keep it snappy.
But fortunately, it wasn't like that. We rehearsed a lot and I learned the songs. And then, yeah, I guess that I managed to find my own within the band and started suggesting ideas, and then this kind of relationship bloomed where it felt like, oh, actually we could, the five of us could be a band and we could make this thing work, and it's not, you know, it's not like a session thing, it's not like this is, it feels good creatively together.
Yeah.
So when did that happen then? When did you have that, I suppose it's going from session to full-time member. Would you like apprehensive to say, I don't like this, this sounds shit, do it this way? When did you start doing that?
It's quite soon after. I guess like maybe after like 4 weeks of sounding each other out.
Okay.
Because I don't have anything else, I think, to offer. You know, the only thing I have is like critique and opinion. And, you know, I think it was with, you know, a massive track for the band, which is Papillon. I suggested having this extended outro, which became like a big thing for the band live for a while. I think that was my first suggestion and it kind of worked. And I was like, oh, I don't have to be scared of this. And they took it on board. I mean, full respect to Tom, Ed and Russ for being so open and allowing someone, you know, people, you know, me and Justin to come in and be creative, which I can't imagine how that felt, having, you know, you've established yourself to this point, to not be so overprotective and be like, well, this is, you know, we know what we're doing. We've sold millions of records. We're headlining this festival. Who are you to come in and say,
yeah,
you know?
But and you were saying before to us earlier about how, you know, when it came to writing new material with them as a band, you weren't afraid to say your piece about things and go, if you like it or not personally, you know, it wasn't like you were trying to put everything in the context of, well, where I'm from, this is where it's at, but for you guys, this is probably a good idea. You would just be a lot more flat and honest about
that's
it. Just go, I either like it or I don't like it. And if I don't like it, you say you don't like it. And
that's the bit that would really terrify me. I think I'd be too much, like in a session position at the beginning, I'd be too much of a yes man.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would never get, I feel like I would never get to that point with a bunch of new people who aren't Duncan, Rob, Pete and Neil. And I would never get to that point where I go, that's shy, I don't
like
it. But
then again, when we were making Big Balloon, I sort of had that vibe with Jamie, who was engineering, helping out Brendan, producing. He seemed to be very much more of a stern voice as to what was going on. He wasn't afraid to say if he did or didn't like something. Yeah. And I was like, ooh, who's this prick? I want to please him.
Well,
we got to make sure that he likes every song. Because if he likes it, then I assume the public will. Because fuck the public. I'm not going to find out what they want.
I don't think it was necessarily that I was like cocky and I was like, oh, this is shit or... But, you know, I felt like that was all that I had to contribute was just my opinion of something creatively, because I don't consider myself to be like, you know, I couldn't just like jump on the keys and like, you know, be in Elton John and be
You don't want to be Jules Holland though, do you? You want to be on Jules Holland, baby. Yeah. You guys are bigger in Europe than... I'm trying to think of another band from the UK that is as big as Editors in Europe. I can't... Nothing really springs to mind in this respect. Well, no one else does, as I mean.
Yeah, I mean, in parts of Europe, I think it's, you know, there's definitely become a generalization that we are just ginormous in Europe.
It's like, it's quite like four nights at the Heineken Stadium in Amsterdam or something.
Music hall. But we have... But we do play arenas, we do play, you know, we did a massive show in the summer in Belgium. And, you know, we are very well received out there. I think, you know... A lot of people think that we're not a big band in England, but we still do well here, but we just don't get the same, I don't know, opportunities that maybe the band had in the beginning. Like, we don't really sit on mainstream radio too much anymore. But yeah, I think we still have an audience. We still sell records and we still do big shows here. It's just a perception.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's UK for Editors as well. It's a great position to be in, like we were saying, having a chat before about it, like, not having to rely on playlists. Obviously, you want them. Every band wants it. Everyone wants those plays. But it's a fantastic position to be in, not to rely on radio play to sell your gigs, basically, as well, which is what we absolutely rely on. If we don't get it, we're totally screwed.
Yeah, so, I think, you know, we understand how fortunate we are in that position. And our fan base is... You know, it's like when we were doing this last UK tour, it felt so good because it doesn't feel like there's people there that don't love the band. It's not like we're the hot ticket in town every night that you're just like, oh, I fancy going to see these guys, I saw them in, you know, Q or magazines and stuff. It's like, you come and watch us because you love our band, and that's amazing. Especially now, as you know, I've been in the band for 3 records, which is the same time that Chris was in the band, etc. We've managed to maintain and preserve and build our fan base.
I think it's an unspoken achievement for any band to sort of get on with what they're doing when they know that they're being shunned. Yeah. Well, not shunned, sorry, that sounds a bit emotional, doesn't it? But it's hard, you know, but to not see it as a shunning when you're not just fitting the marketable channels that music is interpreted and received in this country.
But it always feels personal, doesn't it? When you get a rejection from any aspect of music promotion, whether it be playlists, press, you can never...
When is music not personal?
Yeah.
It's like you're saying they don't like me as a person. How am I supposed to take it?
It's not something that we take personally. We like have a vendetta against people. Like, but it's, you know, it's just one of the things. You just sometimes go like, why? You know, just why?
There's no answer.
And in our position, I guess that's fine because we do have a fan base and stuff. But it frustrates me as well when you see other people that I know that should be on the show or... You know, and you just go, why isn't that happening for this person here? And I wish I knew the answers, because you just don't.
I think quite often it's just down to like 4 people.
Yeah,
you know, to make that decision, and
you have to rely on those people actually giving a shit as well.
Yeah. There's such a desire as well in British music for the new. And I think it's often at the detriment of what else is being created. You know, it's just, everyone wants the new buzz thing. And we'll just dismiss anything that is coming out. Like, I think all of Editors' albums in the UK have got to top 10. I think a majority have got to top 5.
Top 5, yeah.
And it's ridiculous, you know, that you don't get radio play or Radio 1. It just baffles me a little bit. And I think it is that desire. We have to have the new thing. We've got to have the new thing. We've got to have it. It's just like it's a bit wrong in my opinion.
But in some ways, I guess that is, you know, it's partly what fuels our fires to keep going and strives and you know, it's us against the world in that respect. You know, we're a band. We're, you know, it's that great thing of when you're a band, you're a gang, and you just, you know, you sit and you slag things off, and you're like, well, you know, we're going to do this, and we're going to. It's, you know, that's, it's good in that sense that it's a fuel to the fire, and I'm sure it's been the same for you guys as well.
I mean, this is they're all going to burn, bitch.
They're all going down.
As soon as we,
start this podcast, wait for series two.
As soon as we started renting vans that had tables where we faced each other, just the bitching session. Session's just got fucking insane.
Yeah, that's a very poisonous council, isn't it? Yeah, question I've got about it. Obviously, you know, with editors, you've toured parts of the world that you never thought you would tour. Any particular places that have either really surprised you in a positive sense, or maybe any places that have scared the shit out of you? Have there ever been those kind of moments on tour that you just experiences you didn't think you'd ever really experience, but in the opportunity, being in such a well-travelled band now, you've probably seen some places where you just go, wow, how the hell did we ever play a gig there?
Like, yeah, I think a lot of it's like that.
Anything further east of even Dresden scares me. So anything further east of Dresden, like, it's just like, wow, I just couldn't imagine what it'd be. I mean, we've played like Budapest and Slovakia and Prague. Yeah. Prague. So, you know, we've done a few, you know, that's as adventurous as we've got, I think. But it's, yeah, and you find those places being such a, I don't know, from a band perspective and a business touring perspective, you do find it like very,
daunting.
Yeah. How do you find it?
I guess because, you know, I joined the band at a stage where they'd been doing that for a while, and also in Airship, maybe because we had the same management and stuff, a lot of the prerogative was to do Europe and focus on it wholly as a whole thing rather than just the UK or whatever. So I'd already done tours, you know, out to Slovenia and things like that, and I mean, it is slightly daunting, but, you know, you start to realise that a lot of the, you know, especially Europe, you know, people are quite similar. They have the same attitudes. I mean, gigs vary massively just from audience receptions. And especially when you have a back catalogue, you start to see, you know, especially with our band, because it goes up in, you know, some places to ridiculous venues, and then we'll drop down to 600 cap in Prague or something. And the record receptions are different everywhere. I think that's what makes what we love about editors so much, is it's just every night is different. There is not like a, you know, we don't do an arena every night and it's the same show and the same songs get a reaction.
Shows to look forward to as well. And,
yeah, you know, I think
troughs in the tours.
There's total peaks and troughs, and different records go down in different ways. Like in Italy, The Weight of Your Love record, which was the first record that I was on, did really well. The single was big there. We sort of became on the verge of an arena band. Like, we've done arenas there and stuff. And we did X Factor Italy and stuff like that, which was just...
There we go.
Kept that in your back pocket.
You know, those things are just crazy. Like, you're in Italy doing X Factor.
You got the Italian Simon Cowell with his hair.
Which was Mika.
Was it? All right.
Amazing.
That's things like that. They're weird experiences that you just... Yeah, it's just bizarre at the time. But.
Well, you've got your one stop off in Mexico, haven't you, coming up?
Yes, we're
the Mexico Shrewsbury, right?
For a day, yeah.
Guadalajara.
Guadalajara.
Smash and grab it. It's like smash and grab out in Guadalajara, boys.
Which should be really good fun. I love, like, me, Tom and Justin went to, after we played America, we went to Mexico to do some, like, acoustic and promo stuff, and just had the best time just being in Mexico City. We kind of stayed in this like weird hostel, but with slash fancy hotel.
It was
boutique.
Not with slash. But when we were there, we did this acoustic gig, and then suddenly, you know, there was like an earthquake alarm, and everyone piled out onto the street, and it was very scary. But at the same time, it's like there's something like super, you know, once in a lifetime moment when you're just on this street. You know, I just remember looking at Tom and Justin like, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, this is just crazy. Like, you know, we're just playing Munich acoustically, and then in this weird hostel, and then suddenly, like, you're on the streets with all these people, and it's just like, this is just weird. Life is just weird sometimes, and it's great as well. So you have those moments, I think, all the time.
J, Chips.
Old school, we've gone back to the chippy. We went to, what's its actual name?
It's the Baths.
Chorlton Supper Baths.
Chorlton Baths Supper Bar? Chorlton definitely Baths. A bar at the end.
I'm assuming that's because it is opposite what used to be Chorlton Swimming
yes.
Pool.
Yes, you are correct. So we got three large portions. A large portion was £2.50. We also got a portion of gravy and curry sauce. We brought them back to my house and we had them before we recorded. Who wants to start off with the critique?
Elliot.
Dealer's choice, you're on.
I thought they were good.
Yep.
I thought for a traditional chippy chip, they had the right amount of sort of undercooked sogginess.
Yes.
But with a good bit of crunch around the sides as well.
Yes. I find it weird how we accept a soggy chip when it comes from a chippy.
We
but
do.
You don't accept it anywhere else.
You
again,
don't.
I refer back to the Cantor's review that was shut today, amongst other places. I like to feel as if we've had a part to play in this, in the dismantling of that place, because it's had a very varied opening schedule ever since that review. It has,
you're right. Yeah.
But yeah, I do find it a curious one, though, how we accept a soggy chip when it comes from a chippy.
But I think it's because they actually get the potato and do it themselves. I don't think they're buying a bag in and frying it. If you're buying a frozen bag and frying it and it's soggy, how the fuck has that happened?
I think also because they're wrapped up and they're together, so you expect a certain extent of moisture.
Stickiness to it,
yeah.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah. So we've got to the bottom as to why chippy chips are soggy.
Yes.
They're decent.
Yeah.
Have I completely chip blocked you there?
You didn't chip on me. I was done. Yeah, I think I agree. I think they were good.
Yeah. I think they're agreeable.
Rob, Andy, anything to add on the chips?
No, I concur with everything that's been said. I'd say like it was a good amount of the traditional sort of stuck together soggy chippy chip, and also the little bits.
Yeah.
Like if you have the soggy chip with the little bits as well, like you get that extra crisp as well.
Yeah.
It's great, and they were very very soft.
I was just going to say the curry sauce was great, and it was better than the curry sauce from last place. I think I actually preferred the chips that we had with Matthew. Where were they from again?
Royal Cards.
I think the chips were better there.
Really?
So, but I can't remember what score I gave for them. So, but I presume it's around 7 because that's kind of what I've been doing for every single
Okay. Okay, well, let's do the scores then. This is my only responsibility in this podcast, to get the scores and then divide it between the correct amount of people.
Yeah, which it always ends up as the same at the minute.
It's always a dead on 7.
Yeah.
But I always forget to. Anyway, Neil.
7.9.
Wow.
That's the highest I've gone.
That is high. Wow. Robin.
6.9.
Scandal.
Andy, 7.4.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Bastard.
Duncan.
7.4 as well.
7.4
bloody score block
as well. Elliot.
I'll go for a 7.5.
7.5. And here we go. How many people are here?
5.
5 people divided by 5. 7.4.
I think that's the chip leader.
I think definitely from the chippy chip point of view, I think it is, isn't it?
I tweeted the front cover of Q Magazine, the December issue of Q Magazine that I've got in front of me. The cover picture is of the 1975. The headline, it caused a bit of a stir with people who follow us on Twitter. So, headline is, in deep with the 1975, the band of the decade gets the bends. The 1975 are the band of the decade, according to Q Magazine. What's your thoughts on that then, guys?
I'd like to start by, can I just...
Yeah, grab it, go on.
It's quite tabloid by Q, isn't it? It's like quite... It's what, like they want a reaction from it, especially from Radiohead fans, because it says "In Deep with a Night in 75," and it feels like the whole photo shoot is geared around trying to annoy Radiohead fans. And it says "The Band of the Decade gets the bends."
I know,
like,
isn't it?
That's really like putting the hook out there, isn't it? Like, what do you think about this Radiohead fan?
So is that a fair comment? A night in 75, the band of the decade?
Probably not.
No,
probably not. But
why not?
Why not, and who is?
I don't know.
Well, who's to say what quantifies it? Success or?
Well, no, because in this post-factual society that we're all in these days, I personally think that, I mean, the big trick that everyone's falling for, the populist trick, is if a lot of people buy something, that must mean it's good.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily the case. 50 Shades of Grey is not necessarily a good book. X Factor is definitely a cancer on the industry and society that we live in, things like that. But in this case, I think in regards to the 1975 as a band, I think they are a band that have characterized the change of musical culture in this decade more than I think they typify that more than anyone else in a positive way. I think that is a positive thing. I think they have they have developed in the public eye in a way that's different to, we were saying, potential others. There's Arctic Monkeys, of course, who are sort of more of a 2007 to 2017 sort of band in a way. Like they are not 2010 to 2020. Exactly. They're not 2010 to 2020. Arctic Monkeys are a band of their own decade, but they're not of this decade. The closest other one we mentioned, I'm just using up everyone else's chance to say these things now, but Alt-J.
Alt-J was the one I thought.
But that's a much more mysterious kind of phenomenon, I think, the Alt-J, sort of the way that was... Yeah, we saw them at the Castle supporting Fiction. 18 months later, they're winning the Mercury Prize, and they're one of the biggest bands on everyone's lips.
Like, creative band, you know.
But the thing is, often with... there's often a question posed to bands in particular. It's like, where does the next Glastonbury headliner come from? Who is the next big band who have the tunes and
well, it's
the
Foles,
charisma,
isn't it?
to headline Glastonbury? And 1975 probably in that category. Like, they could do that.
Well, yeah, but they've already played the future headliner role, which is third from the top on the main stage.
I'm not sure.
You're not
maybe?
Sure?
Yeah. I think they've definitely been high up on that main stage. I think they would definitely see their next natural progression is to grow into that slot.
Well, if the National can... The National were second to headline, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think culturally, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in the last few years, I don't think I've seen someone have a hand in culture maybe as much. In a stylistic point of view, I remember like going into Zara... And there was a range called 1975 where it was like everything was black. And yeah. I just thought this is entirely stylized around that band. Mm. And in that sense, it's quite bizarre to have that impact on, you know, culture. And I remember there was another thing I can't remember. I think it was for the government, actually. I can't remember what the campaign was about, but they used the kind of square-shaped... fluorescent light kind of thing.
A lot of people called them up about it.
I think it was for Brexit, actually. Yeah. And you do kind of wonder, like, have you done that because that appeals to a younger market? Yeah. You know, things that like that that just seep in, I'm just kind of like, you know, they definitely are influencing young popular culture.
They're treading the line, aren't they, that can do that. They're sort of alternative enough to be alternative, but in the mainstream to influence things. Yeah. And that's what Glastonbury headliners do, essentially. Like,
does that make them the band of the decade? I don't know, because I still don't feel that they've got that crossover song yet that goes from, you know, your 16-year-old to your 60-year-old that's the universal.
Could you argue it's their latest song? Could that be the one? Two Time.
No,
the one that sounds like Wayne Wonder.
I don't think, you know, my mum is going to listen to that, and that, you know, she's going to have an emotional
what
resonance.
Does your mum listen to?
I mean, to be fair, she probably Extreme. Quite like that. I mean, she listens to Extreme. I mean, she does like, you know, a lot of different stuff.
And Extreme, of course.
But is that going to happen now in general? That's what I would kind of ask, is like, do we have that kind of Do I anymore that is such, you don't get those songs that come around that are so globally unifying.
But I think what you pointed out before about the use of their name and image to be applied to other aspects of popular culture, money-making culture,
totally.
I think the fact that they've really capitalized on that, but at the same time, I mean, they are so flippant. I mean, Matt is so flippant in interviews about how he writes his lyrics or where ideas come from, and admittedly you could argue that they've ripped off some excellent songs, and they definitely have. If I Love It If We Made It is a rip-off of Blue Nile's Downtown Lights. It totally is, but
and probably like, unashamedly so from his perspective.
Yeah, exactly. He would be the first to go, went with that, and that's totally fine, whatever, you know. Like, if it turns people onto that song, all up for that happening.
On the face of it as well, if it wasn't them and someone told you a band's ripped off this song, you'd be like, fucking great.
Yeah, I think I said it to you, like, I was like, when I heard that song the first time, I was like, they've completely ripped that off, but if I had the opportunity, I'd do the same thing. Totally would. And to be fair, it doesn't take away... I've had people say to me that his lyrics are very contrived within that song, I Love It If We Made It. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it is kind of a smorgasbord of all the...
hot topics.
Of all the hot topics and problematic phrases that have been sort of cursed upon us over the last 2 years. And yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's Brexit and it's, you know, grab a by the pussy kind of stanzas, as they'll say in years to come. Yes, it comes across as that can come across as contrived, but it's authentic at the same time. I don't think he's, you know,
I think
we need to get down to the point that you know him. you went to school with him, Elliot.
Yeah, I went to school with all of them. Like,
give us an insight into the band of the decade, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's a bizarre situation because obviously we were, I guess, friends, and you know, we grew up together. I watched their rise, and you know, they've watched my rise. And I guess from my point of view, watching it happen was a first, you know, you always have that thing of like, you know, it's just the friends thing, like, oh, well, this, yeah, you know, they've got this far. I'm sure they're not going to get that far. And then obviously things start to, you know, it's just that, it's that traditional thing, isn't it? As friends, you kind of slightly have that jealous pang of someone getting super successful. Yeah. But then at the same time, it's like, this is amazing because it sort of validates the point of, you know, at a certain point in the music industry, you can get frustrated with it and go, this is all a farce. And there was always that thing of, I just always thought it was a back office deal and things didn't just happen.
Yeah.
But watching that happen, it did just happen. And the spark happened. People came to gigs. There was just this excitement that did take over the world. Yeah. And I think that's an amazing thing to watch.
Well, no, it's I think it's even more extraordinary considering how odd the band name is. It doesn't really come out of anything. I mean, I know there's a meaning behind it. There is a meaning behind it, but musically speaking, it doesn't really evoke anything.
Well, I think that's the point, though, isn't it?
It's... well, that it's such a blank canvas.
Yeah.
Hence all their artwork being as plain as it is.
Well, it's ambiguous, isn't it?
Yeah, but I just think it'd be really... you know, you don't know where hype comes from. And also, when we were picking our name and you were picking your band names around the same time, not that it was a hard time to pick band names, but... You look back on it now and go, wow, you know, when you pick a band name, it is for life. Like, don't fuck this up. Don't call yourselves Percy Pervert.
Which we almost did.
Which we almost did. But luckily we saw Sentiment with Dutch Uncles.
It was never going to be the band name. So they had band names before that. And then...
well, yeah, they would Drive Like I Do.
Drive Like I Do, Big Sleep and other things. And then Matt started this side project called The 1975, which he kind of made this shoegazy track because he was like, I can't do this in this, and it's going to be called The 1975. And I think he got the tattoo of it. And then he was like, oh, I've got a tattoo of it now. And it was from this book and stuff, and they ended up sticking with that name. I mean, are they the band of a decade? Maybe for people of our generation, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe that's the counterpoint for us. Like, when Give Yourself a Try came out, I felt like I was listening to it as like a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
And my sort of like more... you know, emo tendencies came in, and I just thought, back then, I would have fucking lived off this song for like 6 months.
You would have from me, like you did with the Boycott Boy.
No, it was very introspective. Boycott Boy was a sharer.
I feel like for us, the band, even the musical moment of our decade is pretty much just the first line of Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, and that's it. You could literally snip it 30 seconds. That's what this decade meant to us. I just want to be one of the Strokes. That's it.
Yeah.
Just cut it off there. A bit of reverb on the end.
But I think, in terms of, band of the decade, or you compare them to Arctic Monkeys, then, don't know, it's an interesting battle. But I think, Arctic Monkeys, for maybe just below our age groups, had such a huge weight. Like, I still speak to people who are 2 or 3 years younger than me, and it's colossal. I think when I listen to, you were talking about it on, I'm kind of with you, I'm slightly more in on this new record than I was previous Monkeys records, but I feel that we were maybe, we weren't in the prime time bracket to...
I think the council, I think the lads aspect of the first album, we had a bad taste in our mouths from other bands that were doing similar things before a band like that could come along
and really
characterize it in a way that was a lot
more... Maybe there was a cynicism between all of us of lad bands that we've been playing with and things around that time that
I'd already been given the Fratellis album as a very, very abused Christmas present by that point. So, I was a bit like, great. And then Arctic Monkeys just felt like at first felt like an extension of that kind of that sort of Larry guitar work, but with a weird band name. And it was a bit like, well, I don't know what to make of this now. However, if you go in, if you go in a more open mind, then it's great from the off.
Yeah, I kind of, because I hate to say it again, I'm a bit older than you. I felt like they got it, that lad rock spot on from Oasis getting me into music, having Arctic Monkeys finally coming round 10 years after Definitely Maybe had come out, to release an album that is better than it was just fucking great. It was just absolutely blew my mind.
And that's an interesting perspective to have someone, I guess older with a bit more perspective, when it was at the time, it's probably just a bit fresh for us and we were just like, nah, this is rubbish.
This is what we're trying to do.
We're way more progressive than these guys.
Yeah.
Have they even heard of a major seventh?
They bettered
everything.
The impossible, almost. They created a better album than Definitely Maybe.
Proven that in their own way, that they have become, I think, they're definitely one of the bands of the decade. Arctic Monkeys is not denying it.
What's the thing that the 1975 in comparison as well haven't had to do yet? They haven't had to reinvent themselves, I guess.
Yeah,
like they've not, like you say, I can't imagine, having heard the singles off the next record, that it's going to be like the Arctic Monkeys album, when you hear it and you go, fuck me, that is different.
Like AM was or whatever.
Exactly. And maybe if the 1975 were to do that on the next album, then perhaps like that more sort of, critical, appraisal would be more appropriate. But yeah, it's...
Should we wrap that up there? Can we talk about Brexit?
Oh my God.
So... It's something that, obviously, I don't know, we've chatted about on previous podcasts, and it's just interesting because you're in a band that's sort of successful. How does it sit with editors for the future of the touring you'll do, the records you'll sell? Is there a bit of uncertainty over what's happening in March?
I mean, I think quite obviously we all voted Remain. We are Remainers, and we love being part of the EU. And that freedom of movement is something that we exercise on a daily basis. It's, that is what we're about as a band. And, punters that come to our show, that, everyone that comes to our shows, a lot of the time the front row is totally international. And there's a lot of people from Europe there. And, no one knows what it all means at the moment, really, like how it's going to affect the industry, whether, we're all going to have to get visas, and every time you go and play a country, you have to get a visa, you have to pay for a visa, you have to get carnets. It's all...
Is that not totally shit scary, the fact that you don't know how any of these things are supposed to work, and yet it's 5 months away?
Yeah, of course. But
five months away.
I think at the moment it still just feels totally... It's mind-blowing. It's hard to comprehend, isn't it? Because everyone's in the same sort of position of just like...
Have you booked anything for Europe next year? Is that is the, is
You know what I mean? Probably can't say on here, but
I know, yeah, but you are looking at the, yeah, of course, specifics. It's not stopping you doing anything.
Of course not. It's not something that we're considering. It's not something that we're considering that's going to slow us down. I mean, obviously, we'll just face the bridges when we come to it.
It's bonkers, though, isn't it? That there's probably never been an occasion in the past where a massive political shift can affect something so massively.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like there's nothing else that could have potentially affected, in particular, cultural exports from the UK.
And like, it's such a mundane thing to impact. It's just a band wanting to go and play in France.
Yeah.
It's or Belgium where you get or Amsterdam get ferried to. It seems so weird.
And I think, you know, the problem is the trickle down effect, I guess, of all of this is like, you know, we'll work out a way to get around it. And if we know, it might mean that we have to spend more money paying visas or whatever, or, you know, it's not going to not go to Europe. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But if you're a younger band starting out, then it totally insulates you. Well, that's exactly why would a label pay for you to now, you know, when you used to just hop on a ferry and go over to France or go to Amsterdam and play London Calling and all these things that start branching you out as a band, when those things dry up, then it's just totally insular.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a band like us, our bread and butter has been through touring Europe really hard.
Yeah.
Even before I was in Edit, that was our remit, was to just get out of the UK, play as many places as possible, because you could get in a van and you could drive around and you could be in a different country every day.
It's just even not from a sort of, you know, band sort of singular thing. It's just more about being able to export a certain type of music that people haven't heard in other countries. And it's that exporting of different genres of music that, you know, it's insane that can't happen anymore.
Yeah,
or potentially will be very more, you know, difficult.
Yeah, and who knows what's going to happen with, you know, record plants. Most of them aren't based in the UK. Most people don't get their vinyl made in the UK. You know, there's all these factors that, or, you know, people who work in music, crew members and things who are all international based or European based, like, no one, it's all up in the air and, like, no one knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. So, about drivers, you know, your drivers, what are they going to, who do they work for? Are they going to pay for their own visas? Are you going to pay for them?
And that's just in the music industry.
Yeah.
And yet we're sort of hypothesizing on something that isn't even certain yet. We can hypothesize on a fact that we'll all need to buy visas. Yeah. That's, you know, that might not be the case. Like it might be years before that's even decided. You know,
but it's crazy how we're 5 months away and no one has any clue.
Yeah,
of vaguely how this is going to work.
Yeah.
So let's try and end it on a positive. So what? So you're off to Germany straight away after in a week.
Yeah, go to Guadalajara first.
Guadalajara, of course.
For a little day.
Shrewsbury, Mexico. You know,
a day trip to Guadalajara.
Yeah.
And then, we start our sort of second European tour of the year.
Yeah.
In Germany.
Okay.
We start in Bremen.
The sound. Well, talking of a future Chips of Chorten, we're going to do, hopefully we're going to take it on the road, which is sort of in the process of confirming, maybe going down to London to do a show. If you want to have any questions or anything you want to ask us for future podcasts, then just tweet at us, and we'll get back to you.
Christmas special,
yeah. And yeah, I suppose we're going to get a Christmas special going. Hopefully, going to try a few guests on. Elliot, you're more than welcome to come back for the Christmas special. By the way,
wow,
it's going to be as any other great business venture was described. It's going to be a bit sort of like TFI Friday.
It's gonna be like
a multiple
that
guest.
That is the dream. That is the dream.
But everyone stood around Neil's kitchen island, just bringing people on two at a time.
Everyone
we've had so far. Pete's gonna be there. Effin and Jeffin.
Pete's coming.
Sure, have you confirmed that?
I don't know. Have I confirmed that?
Have you talked to his agent?
I haven't yet. He's very.
His agent is dad.
The problem is though, Elliot. By you saying yes now, you're the only one to confirm to be on this at the minute, so it could just...
I'll be there.
Yeah, there you go. So we'll do a Christmas special, we've got all the podcasts, and then we'll probably end season one after the Christmas special, and we'll maybe come back in February next year. So that's the
season
plan.
Season one.
Yeah. So yeah, but thanks as usual to Rob, Andy and Duncan.
Welcome.
And very... Cheers, Elliot. Thanks for...
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
cheers.
Thank you,
cheers,
mate. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.